This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
Hello and good afternoon to you. I'm Sophie Johnson and welcome to the Country Hour. Great to have you along for the program today. Coming up on the show, you're going to meet two out of four of the new National Farmers Federation presidential candidates as current President David Johinki wraps up his two terms. We'll also head up to the Atherton Tablelands and hear from the dairy farmers that are one of the largest employers in the area, as well as from a local potato grower who, amidst the South Australian potato shortage, is being offered some pretty high prices for his produce. First, though, the company behind Roundup says it's getting ready to launch a brand new herbicide in Australia. Bayer says it's the first new chemical of its kind to hit the market in more than three decades. But not everyone is convinced it's the answer to the glyphosate resistance, Brandon Long reports.
It's called icofolin methyl, and global agribusiness giant Bayer says it's the first new chemical specifically designed to kill sprouted weeds by attacking their leaves in three decades. It's already going through the approval process in Europe, the US, Canada and Brazil, with an application in Australia on the cards next year. If approved, it could be in use on local farms by 2028. Warren Inwood from Bayer Crop Science Australia and New Zealand says icofolin isn't replacing glyphosate, it's meant to work alongside it.
I don't see icofolin as a direct replacement. I see it probably more as an alternative for growers to access a new product to control Roundup resistant weeds, more difficult to control weeds. It has been a great challenge. I think that is the holy grail in R&D herbicide activity, is trying to find something to replace Roundup or glyphosate, which is as safe as glyphosate.
Like Roundup, icofolin's what's called a non-selective herbicide, meaning it'll kill all plants it touches. And there is a big need for new chemistry, with some weeds becoming practically immune to glyphosate. The Grains Research and Development Corporation says herbicide resistance is costing Australian growers about $3.3 billion every year. Warren Inwood says it's performed well in local trials, especially against one of farmers' biggest headaches, glyphosate-resistant ryegrass.
So far, the trial results look very exciting. So, trial data to date does demonstrate that it will be a novel solution and it will combat a significant number of resistant weeds, including ryegrass, actually, and other hard-to-control weeds.
On the ground, farmers like Stuart McIntyre on Queensland's Darling Downs are hopeful.
I think it's always pretty exciting as a grain grower or grain producer that we've got extra arsenal in our weaponry against the constant battle of weeds.
He's noticed that even common thistles are tougher to kill these days. What used to take a light dose of glyphosate now needs a mix of different products. He says a new option is especially needed in areas riddled with ryegrass. But like most farmers, he's watching the price tag.
I've been only farming 13, 14 years now, and in that short amount of time, I've noticed thistles going from a fairly low dose of Roundup killing them to now having to use those complementary other herbicides along with glyphosate to knock down that thistle. So to be able to use something else again would be of great benefit. We hope that this new product won't see a big costing so that it can be useful to growers without a high price tag with it.
But not everyone's convinced. Environmental group Friends of the Earth Australia says there's still a lot we don't know, especially about long-term effects. In a statement, land use researcher Anthony Amos says there are currently no details about the potential impacts on birds, bees and aquatic life or spray drift and water contamination. Before it can be sold or used, the new weed killer will need approval from the Australian Pesticides and Veterinary Medicines Authority, the APVMA, which says it draws from a wide range of data during the approval process. Even without publicly available data, University of Sydney Emeritus Professor Ivan Kennedy says the development is significant.
Yeah, I know. I definitely think it is groundbreaking. But nevertheless, it's got to go through all the process of pre-registration, then registration. A label has to be produced that will inform farmers exactly how to use it. I agree, it's not the same as glyphosate. It's not a replacement for glyphosate. It's kind of an adjunct or complement.
He says early details suggest the new herbicide will only need small doses to be effective, which could mean less residue in the environment.
There is then the issue of the rates of use. I understand that it's a very sensitive process, so they don't need to use much. So that means the question of residues in the environment may be less as a result of that.
Warren Inwood from Bayer says the company's R&D focus now is on sustainability and precision.
You know, all these new molecules that are being in development really are much more targeted in terms of their efficacy, but they also have much better environmental outcomes and environmental profiles. So I think that is a really critical point. In essence, it's better for the grower, but also better for the consumer.
Warren Inwood, Managing Director of Bayer Crop Science Australia and New Zealand, ending that report from Brandon Long. And Brandon has written an article. If you want to read more, head over to abc.net.au/rural, and it should be the top story there. 12 past 12 on the Country Hour.
Join your local ABC team when the sun rises each weekday. Our team is out in the community. We curate the news, weather and your local rural report. Join us for breakfast right here on ABC Local Radio.
On your radio, online and on the ABC Listen app. This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
On October 20, the National Farmers Federation will elect a new president as David Johinke wraps up his two terms as the head of the Peak Farm Body. Elected by the Members' Council, which is made up of representatives from the NFF's members' organisations, four candidates have put their hand up for the top job. Two are from Queensland, one from WA, and one from New South Wales. Brooke Tindall spoke to the candidates, starting with Hamish McIntyre, who operates a mixed farming business in southwest Queensland and is currently a director of the NFF.
We have a mixed farming business. We value add all the commodities we produce through our cattle and is the main thing we do. So we have a breeding operation based around Kanawai Downs and in the Quilpie region of southwest Queensland, and then we bring a lot of those cattle back to our sort of backgrounding areas around St George and Dhurrumbandi and up at Roma. We grow our own grain. We have two feedlots. We also, as a diversification, we are in the meat chicken business too around Bow Desert. We also, have a Dorper operation. You know, we breed fat lambs and still have some merino wethers out at Quilpie too. Involved in many different things, they all have their ups and downs, but usually there's enough going okay to keep us travelling along okay, yeah.
Tell me a bit about your experience in ag advocacy.
First got involved with Cotton Australia, board of it, and a lot of that was based around water politics and what was going on in our region of Dhurrumbandi and St George, and a lot of the misinformation out there, and we're always encouraged by our father to get involved, don't just complain, and so took his advice, and it takes time, but I certainly believe, Mary and I do, we get more out of these roles than you actually put in, so it's well worthwhile doing, and I'd encourage any young people to get involved. And from there, I chaired Cotton Australia, but at the end of that cycle, and then moved on to the NFF board, so that's been my progression. But yes, it's all about just trying to, obviously advocate to the policymakers and you know, call out bad policy, particularly when we need to, and you know, relevant to all the areas we're involved in. So, but also help create good policy too, if we have the opportunity to do it.
You're running for the presidency of NFF now. Tell me a bit about the opportunities that you see for that position.
Look, again, I think it's just that progression we've just discussed. So I think it's a great opportunity to, on behalf of all Australian farmers, to really work hard to help government create good policy that will, you know, underpin us, you know, our viability. I mean, cost of production is our big thing. We see across all the commodities we produce. It's, you know, it's very tight. And the fundamentals too that really concern me are, you know, that the, you know, we're living hand to mouth due to it not manufacturing in Australia, our fertilisers, refining, you know, fuel, you know, and things like glyphosate tech. I mean, you know, to think that our shipping lanes could be constricted and, you know, within 6 months we'd be out of glyphosate is a real worry. And I mean, that'd have a massive effect on the cost of living, you know, as we know, right throughout Australia, because of the enormous you know, importance of products like glyphosate. So look, I just hope that we can, you know, if elected, really work hard on all those areas to encourage government and show them that it's so important. You know, it's not just a cost of living, it's a food security issue, and, you know, a security issue also. So with regards to, you know, making sure we can, you know, look after ourselves in Australia in times of crisis. So, you know, we don't want to be relying on overseas countries to supply us with the fundamentals of what we need to produce food and fibre in Australia, do we? So I'm very strong on, you know, trying to help in that area particularly. Again, one of the big areas too that we, you know, we really got to work together, you know, with governments is on infrastructure. I mean, the roads in our region, if you coming, you know, east from, you know, Western Queensland, are really in a terrible state, you know, because there's so much of our grain and cotton and livestock are moving east, whether it's going to feedlots or and then on to processing works. And I just think, again, governments, you know, need to really look at that, because again, it is a fundamental that we're able to you know, move our produce by rail or road, cost effectively, but it's also in a timely manner, you know. And some of these roads are getting to a state where they are really dangerous. So, you know, we right across Australia, we've really got to get government to understand the importance of that infrastructure piece and how important it is to us being viable as farmers.
Southwest Queensland farmer and NFF president candidate Hamish McIntyre. From the South Burnett region, cattle farmer Georgie Somerset is the former president of Queensland Lobby Ag Force and is currently a director of the NFF.
We have a cattle property west of Kingaroy, northwest of Dalby in the beautiful South Burnett, and it's multi-generational. Our son and daughter-in-law are running that property, and it's just a fantastic base to be able to do things from.
Tell me about your background in advocacy work.
So I got involved in advocacy probably way back in the late 1980s around agritourism, and then particularly in the 90s when there was a lot of work happening around rural women and advocacy for their role in agriculture. And then over the last 10 years I've been involved with AgForce particularly. I've always been an active member, but became involved in the leadership there. And about 4 years ago joined the NFF board.
And now, out of your history in advocacy, are there any big moments or achievements that stand out to you?
At AgForce there were some big things, and I think particularly protecting the Great Artesian Basin was a really significant one. But I also think just the solid policy work that goes on in an organisation, and then things like the Schools to Industry program, where you've actually got people going into schools across Queensland, sharing with young people about careers and about where their food and fibre comes from. So just being able to underpin those sorts of things, as well as some really big pieces around land management and policy changes.
A big topic at the NFF conference where we are now is sustainability. What opportunities do you see particularly in that space?
It's interesting, isn't it? Because I think of sustainability and there's a lot of discussion about environmental, and at AgForce we were able to spin AgCare out as a natural capital auditing system, which is, you know, a subsidiary. But I also think about sustainability as our businesses and our industry and us as people and how we can sustain our organisations. And I think that's just as critical. And there was some discussion in some of the panels about how important it is to not just think about the environment, but to think about the people and the economic element, and to make sure that we're there for the long term, that our, you know, our families are around, our communities are strong. and that we've got the landscape managed in that sustainable way as well. So I think that's an interesting piece around the economy and the people as well as the environment.
What opportunities do you see for the NFF in the near future?
I think the NFF's role in Australian agriculture is critically important, and having that united voice on behalf of families like mine who can't afford to spend all their time going to meetings and writing submissions and being across all the policy changes, it's so important that we have a really strong national organisation. So I see opportunities for us to really make sure that the things that are coming out, so, you know, for instance, the Ag and Land Sector Plan that comes out, so that there's a plan, but we have to make sure it has no adverse effects on our families' businesses and on our farming businesses. And so I think that's the critical role for the NFF, is being part of those discussions, but then making sure that we're translating that back to what does it mean for the NFF members, which are the people who are actually growing the food and fibre.
What key issues and policies do you see might be a focus in the next few years?
Well, certainly sustainability and the environment. I mean, that's very clearly this government's, they're early in their term. They're going to be pushing the net zero piece and making sure that ag is at that table. I often talk about that, about the need to be in the room to try and protect our piece. But it is also trade policy, it's tax policy, it's about being across all of those things. And I just don't think you can ever take your eye off the ball or where the government's heading next. And it's critically important that we're doing that, and that we also maintain trust with the community about what we're doing in agriculture.
Queensland cattle farmer Georgie Somerset, who also sits on the ABC's board, speaking to Brooke Tindall about her candidacy for the NFF president. And I'll bring you more from the other two candidates in the show throughout the week. You're listening to The Country Hour. I'm Sophie Johnson, and it is 21 past 12.
On your radio, online, and on the ABC Listen app, this is The Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
When Robert Watson rejected fertilisers and pesticides to regenerate his land, he challenged the conventions of dairy farming. The Watson's processor refused to take their milk after the family started value adding, making cheese on their farm at Miller Miller in far north Queensland. But that was decades ago. And as Robert and his partner Michelle Bell Turner explained to Jennifer Nichols, there's been so much consumer support for Mungali Creek Dairy's biodynamic products. They're now one of the Atherton Tablelands' biggest employers.
The main point of difference with our business is that we've chosen to farm regeneratively and biodynamically. So we moved strongly away from the conventional model to look after the land so it's there for future generations, and finding a way that created a niche product, a high-quality milk that actually meant it was viable for two families to stay on farm.
How long have you been at this now?
Dad bought the farm in 64 and we bought the farm off Dad in 1986, so that's about 40 years that we've been doing it. I did conventional dairy for 2 years when I took the farm over, and it just felt wrong. The fertilisers, the poisons, chemicals, it was just an expensive way to farm, and it just didn't feel right, and I didn't get the results I was after. So it took us quite a while to work out what to do, but because the soil was so out of balance, we had to start remineralising the soil. So we did some soil tests, found it was missing, remineralised the soil, and that in conjunction with the biodynamic preps and some foliars and stuff like that, got the whole thing going. And once it was going, the biodynamic preps just kept it going the whole time.
The pastures are really diverse, and we've got mixed species, perennial grasses, a range of tropical legumes, and we plant both winter and summer pastures so that we've got extra feed for the cows in times of excess rain or not enough feed.
We rotationally graze, so they get moved twice a day. They get milked twice a day, so they get moved twice a day, yeah.
To fresh pasture?
Fresh pastures, yeah. And because it's such a high rainfall area, we've got concrete lanes between the pastures, so it saves them making a mess.
So that really would reduce the erosion then, I'm imagining?
Quite a long shot, yeah.
Pretty much any time there's any leftover profitability, it either goes back into helping the farm, or because we're an on-farm processor, so we're vertically integrated. We don't just farm, we manufacture our own products, we distribute them, and we've also got an on-farm cafe. And in Cairns City, we've also got a little ice creamery, which is our latest venture. So that vertical integration means that there's a lot of resources that continually need to go back into growing and looking after the business, but that ultimately gives us a longer term return.
We've got a Misty Mountain brand, which is a conventional Jersey brand, and we've got the biodynamic brand, which is Mungali Creek Dairy. So in the Mungali Creek Dairy, we do milk, Greek yogurt, which is a naturally drained yogurt. We do a natural set yogurt, which is set in the cup, so it goes in the cup as milk, and then it sets into a yogurt in a hot room, and then it's cooled down. We do a ricotta and quark and a feta. When we've got a surplus of milk in summer, we do Mangalia, which is a sort of Romano-style cheese, but without the lipase. And then what else? We do ice cream. So we just started doing ice cream.
What sort of interest are you finding in people coming to the farm and learning from what you do there?
Oh, well, one, we can't keep up with demand. So that gives you a pretty good indication that it's a growing business. Our cafe is called Out of the Way because it's a long way out of the way. And people do come that distance to try what we make here.
And how many cows are you running and what breed are they?
Oh, we milk about 600 cows all up. That's across three farms. And the breeds are predominantly Jersey, but there's some Ger in there, there's some Frisians, there's some red cows, it's a bit of everything, yeah.
We're wanting the components, so we're more inclined to go towards the Jersey, the Swiss Brown and the Aussie Red for the high components. And
lovely cream.
Yeah, definitely, and that's one of the products that people are constantly chasing, and obviously we're using a lot in our ice cream, but we do also have a beautiful pouring cream, but it's always in short supply.
And so what's happened to the dairying industry on the Atherton tablelands over the years since deregulation in 2000?
It shrunk.
How much have the numbers changed?
So I think the deregulation is about 200, it's about 38 left now. Eight of those farms supply Mangalia, yeah.
Yeah, so obviously the farms that supply us are smaller family farms, but it's still quite a significant portion of the remaining farms.
Such an interesting model because so many people have just left the dairying industry, and yet here you are proving that by doing something different, you've managed to grow.
Yeah, definitely need to think outside the square. And because Rob had chosen that pathway of biodynamic regenerative farming 38, 39 years ago, that gave us the point of difference when deregulation happened, that we had a unique product already. And so that really gave us a head start.
Establishing all of that must have been pretty full on.
It's cost a fortune over the years, yes. You've got to develop a good relationship with your bank manager, search for grants. We did try a bit of equity crowdfunding, which worked. So we've tried a lot of different things over the years to get the money to grow the business.
And how many people are you employing now?
We've got about 87 full-time equivalents. That's across three farms, two retail outlets, manufacturing, two distribution centres and sales and support staff.
Crikey.
Yeah, so we're one of the largest employers in our region, and that's grown from just three family members working 15 hours a day when we started.
What's been the best thing about this journey? Because there would be lots of challenges.
It's always been a challenge. Like when we first started converting over to biodynamics, we didn't know what we were doing. Very few people had done something similar in the tropics, so we had to learn from scratch. And then we finally got to a point where we were profitable. And then they deregulated the dairy industry and that collapsed. So then we had to find something new to do with our milk. So we chose to value add. So it took us a while to learn how to do that. And we started off with cheese. So then we started doing yogurt. And then the local dairy industry said you couldn't supply two processors. So they considered us as a processor and them. So they stopped picking up our milk. So then we had to start finding what are we going to do with the rest of our milk. We were selling about 80% of our milk to them at the time. We started selling milk, and that was our biggest growth product. So it's just grown and grown and grown from there.
We're here because of the support of our community. It's great to have that constant thanks from the community for the products, and I think that's one of the things that keeps us going and keeps us doing what we do.
Michelle Bell-Turner and Robert Watson from Mangali Creek Dairy chatting to Jennifer Nichols at Agvention in the Mary Valley. And we'll check in with the Weather Bureau shortly, but while we're up in the north, yesterday on the Country Hour, we brought you a story about how fresh potato prices have increased due to a shortage caused by drought across South Australia. Now, while this is happening, some far north Queensland growers are reaping the rewards. The Atherton Tablelands is home to about 30-odd potato farmers. Local grower and marketer David Nix says he's being offered pretty much double the price he usually would for his produce.
South Australia's had a very, very hard season with drought conditions. South Australia and Victoria, which is where most of the potatoes in Australia are grown now. And with that in happening, it's increased the prices. We've been looking at probably the best prices we've seen in potatoes for a very long time.
Yeah, so how much are the Tablelands potato growers getting?
Well, I'd say across the board, it's virtually double what we've been getting in the past. And, you know, when you think they're getting bulk of potatoes right at the moment are bringing about $1,500 a tonne at the market.
So when you're looking at like a tray of potatoes, what's that value now compared to what it was?
a trade, depending on what potato it is. Okay, ordinary potatoes that everybody buys in the supermarkets, they're about double. So you're going from about 70, 80 cents they were getting to $1.50. Yeah, that's a kilo. And our gourmet potatoes, which are Dutch cream and Kiflers, have driven not quite double, but they're up to $40 a box, and washed are up to $50 a box. And box being 10 kilo for Kiflers and a 15 kilo for Dutch creams. So it's a considerable increase in price. But, of course, nobody knows it's going to do this. So, I mean, you've only got what you normally grow anyway. You don't grow extra.
So it's been a really good year for the prices. How many people are reaping the rewards of this?
Oh, yeah, yes. Look, you know, the ones that probably will miss out to some degree are those that grow through the processes, which is the majority of potatoes grown on the tableland are growing for Arnott's and Smith's. And that's a contract price, so they sort of miss out a bit. But everybody else, yes. Not that we've got a huge amount of growers. There's about 30-odd growers left on the tableland, which used to be 150. And, you know, those 30-odd growers are certainly going to have a good season.
Yeah, and how has the season been? When did harvest kick off, and what's that quality of the potato looking like?
Yes. We've only just kicked in with the new season. Well, the upper tableland, they dug early. They have made a thing of planting very early. And this year they had an exceptional crop. Well, most of them did. And a few of them got caught with weather. But most of them did very well.
And you do a lot of marketing for other potato growers as well. What sort of demand is there at the moment?
Oh, it's, yes, extreme. You know, it's very rare that the merchants these days are ringing you looking for potatoes, and that's happening this year. And merchants right up and down the coast from Melbourne to Brisbane are all ringing looking for supply.
How quickly are the potatoes being snapped up by the merchants?
Oh, as quick as we can dig them. You know, in the week we dig them, they're gone.
Have you seen something like that before?
Not for a long, long time, no.
Atherton Tablelands potato grower and marketer David Nix. It's Sophie Johnson here with you on the Country Hour. It is 32 minutes past 12.
They've infiltrated Heart Quiz.
Hello!
And they're giving it to Gleeson.
I'm not 3,000 years old like you, Tom.
I own a house and you never will.
New Heart Quiz Kids. Help. Stream it now on ABC iView.
This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
Over to the weather now, and we have Harry Clark on duty at the Weather Bureau this afternoon. Hello, Harry.
Good afternoon, Sophie.
So there's still some fires burning with some watch and acts in place around the Wide Bay. How are conditions looking today?
Yeah, certainly another very warm October day across central and southern Queensland. We do have relatively light winds today, though, which is keeping those fire danger ratings a little bit lower than the last few days. But in saying that, we still have high fire danger ratings for the Capricornia, Central Highland Coalfields and Southeast Coast District today. So still very warm and dry out there, as you mentioned, and some areas of smoke haze to go with that. When we look more broadly across the state, very little rainfall falling or even cloud across the state at the moment, quite sunny conditions, the exception being the very far north. We do have cloud building around the far north Queensland coastline at the moment. That will herald the start of a bit of a showery few days for the North Triple Coast and Eastern Peninsula over the next few days.
And for the rest of the week, particularly in that central Queensland region, how will conditions change, if at all?
Yeah, the main change over the next few days will be increasing heat. So at the moment we have a trough just sitting through South Australia, and that's starting to draw some very warm northwesterly winds ahead of it. Now, that means initially the focus of this increase in heat will be felt through southwestern Queensland tomorrow. Birds will go in for a very warm top of 42 degrees, and that heat will start spreading further east into Thursday and Friday and indeed Saturday. So really the remainder of the week will be really dominated in central and southern Queensland by quite warm or quite hot conditions even, and very dry conditions too. So for as far as throughout the Wide Bay and central Queensland, really no rain for the next few days. We do see some thunderstorms returning to much of the interior of the state on Thursday, but in terms of any significant rainfall out of it, it's looking quite slim. We'll probably have to wait until we get to more like Sunday and Monday. We start seeing more general increase in moisture across the state and a bit of a cloud band start to form. So in the short term, quite dry, quite sunny and very hot for October, and then a bit more unstable from Thursday and Friday onwards, mainly through the interior.
And how about those conditions up further north?
Yeah, certainly the far north is probably the one spot of the state that's seeing a bit different conditions at the moment. As I mentioned, we do have cloud building just out to sea at the moment, expecting that to drift slowly across to the west onto the coastline tonight and into tomorrow. So we do expect to see, on the coast in particular, around up to sort of 20 or 30 millimetres both tomorrow and on Thursday with those shower activities, even the chance of a storm throughout much of the peninsula as well. So some moderate totals possible up there, mainly north of Cairns at this stage, or some of that will fall on the north, the Cassowary coast as well. Really not much south of Ingham. So outside that far north, really quite dry. But that far north, definitely in the chance of seeing some showers over the next few days.
Yeah, and even in the last 24 hours, there was a little bit of rain in that north and northern area. How much is on the way?
Yeah, in the last 24 hours, we had generally 5 to 10 millimetres around that sort of Innisfail Tully area. We'll be a little bit heavier in terms of totals in the next 24 hours. So looking at tomorrow, we do see up to sort of around 30 to 40 millimetres through the Daintree and parts of the Eastern Peninsula, a little bit less further south around the Cassowary coast, more like 15 to 20. Best chance of seeing some rainfall throughout the North Triple Coast will probably be on that Thursday. We do see those falls in coastal areas up to around 20 or 30 millimetres or so. So not crazy huge totals like we saw around a fortnight ago, but certainly not nothing, not just light showers, some moderate falls in there too.
Yeah, and I see there is still a strong wind warning in place for the peninsula and Cooktown coast. What's the situation there?
Yeah, that's correct. So we do have southeasterly winds for the Cooktown and peninsula coast, up to 30 knots today. That's a strong wind warning threshold, so we do see strong wind warnings current for those two waters. Elsewhere in the state, very light winds, though, over the next few days. Generally southeasterly, 10 to 15 knots for northern Queensland. Tending more northeasterly once you're south of around Yeppoon and becoming a bit fresher as you head into the southeast coast. So really just expecting those strong wind warnings to remain for today only for the very far north, back down to under 25 knots for all waters tomorrow.
Yeah, and what about the winds on the ground?
Yeah, on the ground, really mainly northwesterly winds tomorrow, particularly through southwestern Queensland, will become quite fresh. So not only will it be very hot out in the southwest, but also quite gusty at times. Those winds in places like Birdsville up around that sort of 30 to 45 kilometre hour mark is a mean wind, and those gusts will be up around 60 or 70 kilometres an hour there. So yeah, quite windy through the southwest, although those wind speeds do decrease as you head further east, generally still from the northwest, some northeasterly sea breezes along the coastline. And that pattern will really be sort of continue the next few days, generally warm northwesterly winds for most areas, with just a subtly change entering the very far southwest on Thursday.
Now, you said before there are some pretty hot temperatures about, but yeah, talk me through those and talk me through the temperatures for the state.
Yeah, certainly so. So when we look at the interior, I guess today we do have those temperatures are really sitting in the mid-30s for most locations away from the coast and around 30 degrees on the coast. But as we look at tomorrow, we do see that temperatures start to spike. So something in the southwest, Birdsville going for 42 degrees tomorrow, Longreach up to 38, Mount Isa 39, and further towards the south, St George 38, Emerald up to 35, and across to Toowoomba up to 32. So generally 4 to 8 degrees above the October average. Still a few degrees off our October records for most areas, but the really main sort of point with this heat is it's quite prolonged. So we see those temperatures maintained right throughout the coming days, and indeed we don't get a proper cool change until probably early next week. So some of these locations are going to be sitting at close to 40 degrees for a number of days in a row, which, I mean, for spring is completely unusual, but for this early in spring is quite notable.
Yeah, wow. And how about temperatures in other areas?
Yeah, along the coast, we do see for the Wide Bay, Hervey Bay going for around 28 degrees tomorrow, Gladstone up to 29. Further north, Mackay going for 29 as well. Townsville up to 31 degrees tomorrow, and Cairns up to 30 degrees as well. In the very far north of the peninsula, still remaining very warm. Weipa going for 35, and across to the Gulf Country, Burketown going for 35 as well degrees tomorrow. So warm elsewhere, just not as warm as the southwest.
Brilliant. Thank you so much for your time, Harry.
Thanks very much.
And a reminder that local fire bans are in place for many council areas along parts of northern, central and southeast Queensland today. This also includes people in the South Burnett, Cherbourg, Gympie, Fraser Coast, Bundaberg, North Burnett, Gladstone and Banana Council areas. where your local fire bans have now been extended and will be in place until the end of Friday, October 10th. During fire bans, you are not allowed to light any fires in the open, but some exceptions do apply for power tools, lawn mowers and essential and agricultural purposes. The full list of council areas with bans in place and more details about what you can and can't do during a fire ban are available on the Queensland Fire Department website at fire.qld.gov.au.
This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
20 minutes to one on the Country Hour. Soon we'll hear about what impact a deadly Indonesian mudslide has had on mining stocks. That story next, but before we get to that, with the current disrupted global trade markets, Australia's $17 billion horticulture industry will have more options to enter new markets, according to the industry's research and development group. A group of representatives of Australian agriculture, dairy, wine, meat and horticulture have returned from a trip to Kuala Lumpur talking about the future trade opportunities. Dr. Mila Bisto is the General Manager of Trade and Biosecurity at Hort Innovation. She told Annie Brown about the trip.
Well, Malaysia, for instance, is Australia's 11th largest trading partner for Australian agriculture. And in 24-25, we had exports worth over $1.8 billion. So with Malaysia's rising affluence and a growing middle class, there's increasing demand for premium imported goods, and that market presents a very strong growth prospect for Australia's food and wine sectors.
And what were some of the conversations you were having there? Is there more interest in increasing our export to Malaysia?
Oh, absolutely. It didn't matter whether we were talking about dairy, who have the number one position for yogurt imported into from Australia to Malaysia, or wine, which is in the top 10. Beef and lamb from red meat is a very dynamic sector. Malaysia consumes the highest per capita beef and lamb in the region, with a really high and growing appetite for premium nutritious protein, and Australian beef and lamb has that is well positioned. And then in our area in horticulture, it's top 13 for us in the market. It's the counter seasonal supply that Australian offers in horticulture. It's got a reputation for high quality, high food safety products, which is really tasty and fresh. And there's a lot of interest in the Australian fruit and vegetables and nuts. Top three to Malaysia are avocados, oranges, and carrots. But on top of that, we do summer fruits and cherries, vegetables more broadly, like potatoes and celery, beetroots. We definitely do quite a lot of nuts, so macadamia nuts and almonds are known as premium healthy nuts up there, and a huge appetite for Australian.
But let's talk trade more broadly here in terms of horticulture. I'm sure the word tariff was brought up a lot in your conversations around international trade. What would you say have been the overall impacts of the US tariffs at the moment on horticulture in particular?
Tariffs are always an interesting environment for our horticultural traders. They can provide just as many opportunities as they do in challenges. So Australia's in a very strong position by having free trade agreements with many of its core trading partners. So such as up in Malaysia, there's the Malaysia-Australia Free Trade Agreement, the MAFTA, which actually presents us quite a strong tariff-free or tariff-reduced environment to trade with Malaysia. So there's been a growing reliance on some of our free trade agreements. Tariffs in particular tend to be disruptive, and in a disruptive global trade environment, there are some opportunities. We do see different changes in the competitors because of what's going on with the US tariffs.
Yeah, so in terms of horticulture, and in particular apples, we've seen some really big trade announcements this year already. So mainland Australian apples will be sent over to China into export, and also the system's going to be made easier to export into Canada as well. Are we likely to see more of these sort of announcements and sort of changes in trade partners as the market remains volatile, I guess, with these US tariffs?
Absolutely, we are. I think that Australian horticulture is prime for export growth. Our premium packouts can go really well into our near neighbour markets, and there are a lot of industries who are ready and primed and just about on the cusp of being ready to export. So I know the Australian government is working hard to negotiate us new market access. The example to Canada for apples is a really interesting one that was not seen as a really profitable or high prospect market just a few years back. But the disruptive environment that we now find ourselves in has changed that situation. And so now we're seeing apples go there. And it's the same with citrus as well. There's opportunities in some of those markets due to trade disruption. So we've seen some recent wins, and I think we'll see some more.
Where are some of the key trade opportunities do you see for horticulture, like in terms of what produce and what markets?
Our biggest export market for horticulture is China, which receives about a third of our export. Other really important markets are typically in our region, so Japan and Korea in North Asia, Thailand, Vietnam, Malaysia, Indonesia in the Southeast Asian region. Of course, we can't forget the UAE and India. So they're probably the areas of most growth where we expect to see our products go, and that's partly due to proximity because the majority of what we're exporting, table grape citrus, for instance, are fresh. So they want to go to a close market so that we can ensure that they are getting a fresh and very high tasting product. And then with our nuts like macadamias and almonds, they tend to go a little bit further afield because they can travel a little bit better. So we have very strong almond market in Germany, in the UAE, in India, very good market in Turkey as well. And macadamias, well, our Australian macadamias travel the world and they're really popular in India at the moment. So I think we can see growth in our near neighbourhood of ASEAN and North Asian region and, of course, China, which is an important area. But look, there's going to be so many opportunities open up in a disruptive global trade environment.
Dr. Mila Bistow, the General Manager of Trade and Biosecurity at Hort Innovation. You're listening to The Country Hour with myself, Sophie Johnson. It is 14 minutes to one.
The social media ban for children under 16 is coming, and we will explain everything you need to know. What's your view? Will it work? How will it affect you? Let us know what's on your mind. Go to abc.net.au/yoursay.
You're listening to the Queensland Country Hour on your radio, online and on the ABC Listen app.
A deadly mudslide at a major Indonesian copper mine has pushed up the value of Australian mines. The mudslide at Garsberg Mine in West Papua has forced the second largest copper mine on the planet to shut down and exacerbated a shortage of copper globally. Copper is a critical for computers that drive huge new data centres that are powering AI technology, and that's led BHP and Rio to scramble for new supplies. There's been a flurry of mergers and acquisitions around the world, and some Australian mines are reopening for the first time in half a decade. Hayden Bairstow, Head of Research at finance company Agrinaut, told Clint Jasper that mining stocks are rising.
The demand story has been really bullish, and I think as we talk more about data centres and, you know, things like Oracle upgrading their cloud outlook, I mean, that's just more sort of demand for copper and for power to sort of underpin what they want to do. You know, we've seen obviously a lot of the bigger stocks in the US really rise on AI and data centres in the last couple of years. So that part of the demand story has been quite robust for a while. Whereas I think, you know, supply had been okay and there were some big projects coming online, which had really, despite all of that positive demand signals, had pushed the market still into a surplus, where these supply issues that we've now seen have swung that pretty quickly the other way. Then the other driver of volatility in copper has been the US tariffs. And that, yeah, for a period this year, we had a very wide price gap between the US copper price and the LME price in London. That has now since narrowed a fair bit, but, you know, that created even more volatility in the copper market over the course of this year.
What's been the Australian response to that market picture? Strong demand, tight supplies. Have we seen new mines coming on? Is there money chasing, you know, previously undeveloped copper reserves?
It's actually been M&A. So we've actually lost a couple of listed companies. Mac Copper is in the throes of being taken over now by Harmony. New World Corporation, which has an asset in the US, but it was Australian listed, has also gone as well. So we've seen a bit of M&A activity on that front. We haven't had too many copper projects get advanced quickly. Probably the only thing that's been brought online is Woodlawn in New South Wales, ACT with Develop. You know, there's some other projects like Nifty in WA that are moving towards a production pathway in the next two years or so. So there is some new supply coming. Better pricing outlook will make funding some of these Australian development plays a much easier pathway. So they're pretty well positioned for some of these assets to get going and get funded. Developer also starting an underground mine at Sulphur Springs in the Pilbara. So there's another smaller copper mine coming online in the next couple of years as well. So it is quite encouraging, I think, for some assets in Australia that have been on the shelf for a long period of time to actually start being brought into production over the next sort of 3 to 5 years, particularly if the copper price is $5 a pound or higher, which it's now approaching in the spot market.
And amongst that M&A picture, are we seeing Australian companies looking overseas to either form joint ventures or take over reserves that are known in some of those copper hotspots?
It's been the other way, really, that offshore companies have been buying Australian companies. I mean, the biggest copper player in Australia, Sandfire, has their two assets, but they haven't been buying anything else. They've got a development play in the US as well, so they haven't been active on the M&A front. But yeah, it's been more the bigger offshore players and private money buying some of these smaller copper development companies on the ASX.
Against the backdrop of all of that, what's your take on why a major global company like Glencore is asking the government for money to keep running, you know, our only copper smelter in Mount Isa? Is it just down to the age of the asset, or it's just fundamentally uncompetitive with the sector in China?
Yeah, 100%. So yeah, the issue with treatment charges on the downstream side of Mount Isa makes that part of that asset largely uneconomic. So yeah, running just the mines and then exporting the concentrate and turning the smelter off would probably make more money than running the downstream. And that's why there's a move to try and get some fiscal support for those bigger pieces of infrastructure, because the last thing we really want is to have no smelting. We're already seeing, you know, alumina refineries close in WA. But again, that's more about the age of the assets than anything else. But, you know, otherwise, unless you're investing in the new technology, you know, it's difficult to compete with countries with much lower power costs than what we have.
Hayden Bairstow, Head of Research at finance company Agrinaut, speaking to Clint Jasper. You're listening to the Country Hour. It is 8 minutes to one.
You're listening to the Queensland Country Hour. On your radio, online, and on the ABC Listen app.
Eggs. It's an industry that boosts the economy in Queensland. It's an important industry. They serve as great cheap food. And on the other hand, the hens work very hard. But what you might not have thought of is what happens to the hens after they work. Almost like rehoming working dogs or racehorses. There are people who rehome hens, and Julie O'Shea is one of those people. The charity is called Who Gives a Cluck? She spoke to Kemi Maguire about the process.
We're a not-for-profit registered charity, and all of us are volunteers, but even with that, we've been able to rehome over 10,000 hens over the last few years, and we've got what we call approved hen parents that apply to us to be a hen parent. About 1,650 families from Gympie down out now out towards Toowoomba and down as far as Grafton.
So who normally takes them? Are these hobby farms that take them on, or?
Yeah, backyard hen owners. So anyone that has backyard hens, they may have other specialty breeds, but there's something when they see what we talk about that they think, look, they'd love to give a home to two or three battery hens that have been health checked, so we bring back the ones not fit for adoption and give them a chance at life, because if not, they would be culled.
Well, it's interesting that you bring up not fit for adoption, because do they require more care? I'm sure they're not a set and forget animal.
Well, no hens are, and that's part of our education process on the other side of the charity, that you can't just buy hens, stick them in your backyard and hope to get eggs and just feed them and give water. They are a companion animal, so they do need checking and caring like you would your dog or cat. Now, with battery hens, it's a little bit more intensive over the first month, because we've got to remember they've never walked on solid ground. They certainly don't know how to climb up, you know, runs or roost. But it doesn't take long at all for them to learn their ways. We've just got to give them some extra support and with nutrients to build up their bones and strength. And then within about a month, they're good to go. They transition into the flock beautifully.
And so you started this idea back in 2017. What first yes. got you there?
It got me there. I had adopted myself rescue hens beforehand, and I, while we service this whole big area, I live down near Mullumbimby. And during those Cyclone Debbie back in 2017, the area decimated, and a local egg farmer contacted me because he hated the fact that he had to cull. He's just got a tiny flock, 400 hens every year. And he said, could I help? So I went over and saw him and thought, well, I could adopt 10 of them, but I'm just going to put it out there on my Facebook, which, you know, didn't have many people there, to say, does anyone want to help these hens, you know, and give them a home? Within 24 hours, I was inundated. So I set up a separate page, and within 3 days, I had commitments to have all 400 adopted. After that, I just went, you know what, this is what I'm going to do. I always wanted to do something with animals, but I thought because of my career it might have been sitting on a board somewhere. But, oh, boy, I love this, getting down into the chook poo and rescuing, rehoming hens. And we only keep the ones not fit for adoption because we're all volunteers and people donate money to us to look after them. But that's why we can only rescue the amount of hens that people commit to adopt, plus 5% more just in case they need to come home with me.
And so continuing on, where are these hens coming from now?
They come from battery farms. A lot of people aren't aware that they still exist. They make up 40% of all eggs sold in Australia still, even though by 2036 they say they're going to get rid of them, but I'm doubtful of that. So there are battery farms all over the place, and this is where hens live their life in a small cage, 6 hens to a bit less than an A4 piece of paper each, 6 hens in a little cage, and they live their life there until just 18 months of old, because commercially they're no longer viable to the egg farmer because they're laying every second day instead of 6 eggs a week.
Oh, okay, so they are still laying at that stage.
Oh, definitely. They're only 18 months of age. Mm. That's, you know, they start laying at about 5 or 6 months. But commercially, they're not viable. But for backyard hen owners, they're perfect. So everyone can feel good about giving these hens a new life and also getting some eggs if that's what they're wanting, of course.
Julie O'Shea from charity Who Gives a Cluck, speaking to Kemi Maguire. It's 1:03 here on the Country Hour. I'm Sophie Johnson, and it's time to head over to the markets. Let's cross to the Roma store sale with David Friend.
Roma agents were still able to pen 8,457 head. All the regular processors, lot feeders and background is present, but not all active. A very good quality yarding pen. At the time of this interim report, the market firmed a dearer for most categories. Yearling steers 200 to 280 kilos, sold from 350 to 520 cents a kilo for the better pens. Yearling steers 280 to 330 kilos, topped at 520 also. Yearling steers 330 to 400 kilos, made to 502 to lot feeders. Yearling steers 400 to 480 kilos, sold from 370 to 502 cents a kilo to lot feeders. Growing steers 500 to 600 kilos, made to 454 to lot feeders. Also, pen runs of oats, fat and bullocks over 600 kilos, selling to 435 cents a kilo to processors. Bulls over 600 kilos to 380 cents a kilo.
Trevor Hess is watching the prices at the Warwick sale yards today.
The supply of cattle into Warwick remained virtually unchanged at 1,260 head, and there was a large variation in quality, especially in the cow section. Buyer representation was good across all classes, and all were active in the market. Most classes sold within a few cents of the previous week's sale, however, heavyweight cows lost 15 to 20 cents. Lightweight yearling steers returning to paddock made to 512, most from 472 to 499. Yearling steers to feed for domestic market made to 530 and averaged from 469 to 474. Heavyweight yearling steers to feed made to 471 to average 454. Lightweight yearling heifers returning to paddock averaged 386 and sale to 414. Medium weight yearling heifers to feed averaged 370, occasional sale to 440. Bullocks made to 445 to average 431. Heavyweight three score cows averaged 352 and the best of the cows made to 375 to average 366. Heavyweight bulls made to 420. This has been Trevor Hess from MLA's National Livestock Reporting Service.
And that's all we have time for this Tuesday on the Country Hour. I'm Sophie Johnson, and it has been an absolute pleasure to have your company on the show today, as always. I'll be back again on the Country Hour from midday after the news tomorrow. Until then, be sure to tune into your local rural reports to get your fresh fix in the morning. Until then, hooroo.